I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Alan Patton, Howard Harrison and Gabriel Snyder Beck Professor of Politics, and the Director of the Program in Political Philosophy at Princeton University. We're discussing his 2014 book, Equal Recognition, The Moral Foundations of Minority Rights, from Princeton University Press. Patton works on the history of political thought and contemporary liberal theory. He is the author of Hegel's Idea of Freedom from Oxford University Press and co-editor of Language, Rights, and Political Theory, also from Oxford. Let me say, first of all, Alan Patton, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So, Alan, I love the book. It's one of the most sophisticated and compelling defenses of liberal multiculturalism I've read. So I should say thanks for writing the book, first of all. And let me ask you, I generally ask the authors to talk about the motivation for writing the book, just to get us started. You've been working on issues about culture and liberalism for a while. You also have important studies on Herder and Hegel, which I've been following too. So what motivated you to write this book in particular?
Well, I guess I've been thinking about issues relating to cultural differences and cultural diversity. I mean, almost literally all my life. I talk a little bit about this actually in the preface of the book. So I was born in Montreal, but my father was American, and so right from birth, he went down to the consulate and had me register as American. So I've been a dual citizen all my life, and have gone back and forth between Canada and the United States, and spent a lot of time in both countries. And so was always aware, even from a pretty young age, that there were interesting differences between, you know, my Canadian cousins and my American cousins. Sort of fascinated by the sort of politics and society of both countries. Growing up more in Canada, I guess, in the U.S., I was also exposed to a lot of the debates that were happening in Canada in the 1970s and 1980s, a lot of which kind of revolved directly or indirectly around cultural questions. So for instance, in 1976, a government was elected in the province of Quebec that was committed to independence for Quebec, and which was very sort of strongly nationalist in its orientation. Its commitment to protecting the French language, for instance, was a prominent part of its political platform. And that issue of Quebec's secession and of French language has kind of simmered on for decades since that time in Quebec. At the same time, in the 1980s, there was a very vigorous debate, especially in Canada, about free trade with the United States. And there was a free trade agreement that was eventually agreed to in the late 1980s, which eventually turned into NAFTA, which we're still talking about. The way that people on the Canadian side tended to talk about free trade was partly from a kind of cultural and nationalist point of view. So would a distinct Canadian culture survive greater economic integration with the United States? So this background made me really interested in questions about the kind of the status of nationalism and of claims about culture in general in politics. And then as I started to study political theory and read, you know, recent developments in contemporary political theory, of course, I became interested in how political theorists in particular thought about these questions and what the implications of leading kind of theories of liberal democracy might be for these kind of competing claims about culture and nationality that one was hearing in our politics.
Do you have a sense as to why it is that Canada and the U.S. have such different multiculturalism policies? Does it derive from the Quebec case, or is there, you know, something broader, different historical set of events that have shaped it?
I think the Quebec case is probably the most important factor. So that you know, before Canada became an independent country in 1867, there had been a kind of fusion of what had been a colony of France and then the British colony in Canada that happened in the 18th century as a result of a war between France and Britain. And so for about a century leading up to Canadian independence, there was already this effort to create a single political community that contained both French Canada and English Canada. And particularly in the beginning, the populations were of roughly equal sizes. So I think this really put its stamp on the Canadian, you know, the early Canadian constitution, on Canadian institutions, and on the political culture. I think, of course, the association with Britain was also a factor. And some historians have pointed to the outsized influence of certain Scots on, for instance, the House of Lords had a judicial committee which had to make decisions about the Canadian, about Canada as a colony and as a dominion after it became independent. That was in effect the Supreme Court of Canada before the 1930s, and the chair of this committee for many decades was a Scot, and some people have speculated that his sense of being culturally distinct from the English helped to influence decisions that committee made. So I think it's primarily the French fact, but also the fact that Canada had this special relationship with Great Britain, which itself is kind of a multinational entity. I think those factors have really kind of shaped Canada in a particular direction that I think kind of diverges in interesting ways from the United States.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, Australia is often the other country that's pointed to as sort of on the forefront of some of these multiculturalism policies. And, you know, it's again, being the heritage of Britain is interesting there. I mean, this isn't at all in your book, but it's, I'm just out of curiosity about your views on this. I mean, how much do you think that the history of particular countries is salient or morally relevant for your view, right? So that, you know, countries that have particular histories that can facilitate multiculturalism, more robust multiculturalism policies, maybe we should expect more of them morally than countries that have less of a history or a more difficult history of integrating or incorporating multiculturalism policies.
I think that sounds very plausible to me. One decision I ended up making, for better or worse, about the book was to some extent at least, I was going to avoid pronouncing on particular policy questions and debates and disputes in particular cases. In fact, even in the cases that I, you know, that originally sparked my interest in the subject. So, although I became interested because of this fascination with questions about free trade and you know, Quebec nationalism and Canadian nationalism and so forth, in the book, I don't end up kind of really circling back and pronouncing on those questions. And I think the reason for that is that the more I studied this topic, the more I became impressed by the importance of the kind of unique history of each society for thinking about these questions, the ways in which different societies have different legal regimes and constitutional structures, also the complexity of the various issues in social science that relate to thinking about public policy decisions. So I ended up kind of focusing the book more on what I call the sort of philosophical foundations of how we think about these questions relating to nationalism and multiculturalism, and trying to think through what do the principles of liberal democracy imply for how we ought to think theoretically about these questions.
Yeah, so let's get into the argument of the book, which is, I think, a little bit difficult to say it in general, because it's, you make contributions in several different areas about the notion of culture, about liberal neutrality, and about recognition. But I think, as you just said, it strikes me that one of the core aims of the book is to set liberal multiculturalism on a new foundation, in part in response to some of the criticisms that it's received, say, in its articulation by Will Kimlicka over the past several years. So we'll go through each of these concepts as you take them up in the book. But I don't know if you could say just a little bit briefly at the beginning, in general, about why it is that you think it's important to put liberal multiculturalism on a new foundation, and what that means.
Let's see. Okay. Well, I guess so the book starts from the premise that modern societies tend to be highly multicultural, and from the observation that different liberal democracies respond to this cultural diversity in quite different ways, and that kind of, I guess, mirroring this difference that we observe in the world are differences in how political theorists think about what the right way is to respond to cultural differences. So, you know, there's, I think, a kind of dominant approach that's maybe particularly common amongst American political theorists, which is to think that, by and large, cultural differences ought to be left for the private sphere. So people have constitutional rights, which allow them to, you know, read what they want in whatever language they want, to join whatever cultural or ethnic associations they want, to marry who they want, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess the thought is that, by and large, cultures ought to be protected by giving people these individual rights and letting them, you know, exercise them in the way that they want. That, I think, that approach in practice in the United States is kind of mirrored in the outlook of many American political theorists, who tend to emphasize, don't tend to mention culture at all in their theories of justice, but instead tend to assume that it would be sufficient for justice to guarantee certain individual rights, to have democratic political institutions, and to create institutions that protect distributive justice, but that there aren't kind of specific requirements relating to cultural recognition or accommodation. And then on the other side, I think there are some countries where it's kind of generally thought that that culture raises important matters of fundamental justice. That so you find many constitutions of countries in which include references to language rights or to language official languages, which go to great lengths to create self-government rights for particular national minorities, and which pay attention to cultural differences in the way that they, you know, think about the symbols of the state and about the holidays and the kind of self-presentation of the state to its citizens. So, and corresponding with, you know, this practice that one finds in many places, there's developed a kind of school of political theorists who think of themselves as working in the tradition of liberal democracy, and who argue that the principles of liberal democracy actually imply that it is a matter of basic justice that certain forms of cultural accommodation and recognition be part of the political and sort of constitutional structure of these societies. So these are the first wave of theorists of this kind included people like Will Kimlicka, who you mentioned. I would also say Charles Taylor, another Canadian, Joseph Raz, Yael Tamir, another Israeli, Avishai Margalit, David Miller. So there's a whole kind of school of people who kind of loosely think of themselves as working within the tradition of liberal democracy and who argue that kind of as a matter of basic principle, liberal societies ought to include some recognition or accommodation of these cultural differences. In reaction to that initial wave of scholarship, there have been there's been a kind of response from the more orthodox approach to liberalism that argues that the kind of benign neglect of issues of culture and nationality in earlier theories of liberalism wasn't an oversight, wasn't an accident, but actually that there were actually good principled reasons not to think that to think that cultural rights are not part of the basic makeup of liberal democracy. The kinds of concerns that these critics, I guess, of liberal multiculturalism have emphasized include concerns about essentialism. So do the multiculturalists end up essentializing culture? They include a concern that multiculturalism might end up kind of inadvertently having certain harms or kind of perverse implications for either members of the cultures or people who would be affected by and live in close proximity to members of the culture. So there's a kind of concern, for instance, articulated famously by Susan Okin, that multiculturalism might be bad for women, right? So that's an example of that of that kind of view. And then there have been kind of philosophical objections to this wave of liberal multiculturalism, which have just questioned whether the arguments really work or not, whether or not the liberal multiculturalists like Kimlicka and Raz and others succeed in showing that liberal principles, in fact, require certain cultural rights. So the book kind of tries to take on each of those kinds of challenges to liberal multiculturalism and to restate the case for multiculturalism in a form that I think responds to the challenges and provides kind of deeper and more robust foundations for thinking that there is a kind of connection between liberalism and cultural rights.
Yeah, that's great. I wanted to take up the first topic, which you take up in the book, which is what is culture? And particularly this has become an issue, as you say, because a number of liberal multiculturalists have been charged with essentialism, that they essentialize the notion of culture, which comes with a host of problems, both empirical and normative. You defend in response a non-essentialist conception of culture, which you call the social lineage account, which focuses not on the substance of culture, but the form of it, on the formative institutions and the identity of members as a result of this formative process. Could you sketch that, the social lineage account, and maybe say a bit about why it doesn't fall prey to some of the problems associated with essentialism or non-essentialism?
Sure. So, I mean, I kind of, if you asked many people what they meant by culture, how they would identify something as a distinct culture. I think, you know, probably the first idea that many of us would reach for would be the idea that people share a culture when they share certain beliefs and values. And so that if we're, you know, if we're looking to distinguish one culture from another, we would tend to look for different patterns of beliefs, beliefs and values. And it's this kind of view that I think people who are concerned about essentialism have targeted, right? They've said that if you look closely at the various groups that are thought of as at least being candidates for having distinct cultures, you find that internally there's a huge amount of variation in the beliefs and values that people have. These beliefs and values are, they're not only heterogeneous, but they're also always in flux. They're very, they're fluid. And you also find that not only is there this internal variation, but there's a high level of external overlap with the beliefs and values that are found in amongst people who clearly aren't members of the a putative culture. And so this has led people to think that there's a kind of problem of essentialism, of defining cultures in terms of some essential set of values or beliefs or practices or institutions that kind of bedevils the effort to talk about cultures as kind of meaningfully distinct entities. So if that's true, then I think a lot of multiculturalism is going to be in trouble, right? Because multiculturalists want cultures to be treated fairly. They want cultures to be protected, to be preserved even. They sometimes want dormant cultures to be revived. And all these aims seem to presuppose that we can kind of meaningfully talk about there being distinct cultures that are treated well or treated poorly, or that are flourishing, that are surviving, that are dying out. So we need some way of identifying what a culture is, what it would mean for a culture to kind of continue or persist over time versus what it would mean for a culture to disappear. So that's kind of the context. The proposal that I try to develop, this is in the second chapter of the book, is that the sort of basic idea is that we think of people as sharing a culture, not when they share some essential set of beliefs and practices and values and so forth, but when they have all shared in being subject to a common formative context, right? They've been, they've experienced a distinctive context of socialization. So they've all, for instance, been brought up in the same language, would be an example of being subject to a common formative context. They've all been raised perhaps under certain administrative and political institutions. They perhaps have lived in geographic proximity to one another, so they've interacted more intensely with one another than they have with people who live farther away. They will have perhaps consumed the same media, read similar books, watched similar television networks and films, and listened to similar music and so forth. So they have a kind of common experience of what we would call, I guess, popular entertainment and popular culture as well. And so we can talk about a group of people constituting a distinct culture when they have had a kind of socialization history, what I call a social lineage, that is, to some extent at least, isolated from the socialization history or social lineage that other people have experienced. So why is this, why do I call this a non-essentialist account? Well, if you think about it, people can share a common socialization experience, but respond to that experience in very different ways. I mean, think about how siblings who've been raised together in a family, so very strongly common experience of formation and socialization, can nonetheless be very different from one another, can have very different attitudes about their upbringing, and yet because they shared this common socialization, it makes sense to think of them as being to some degree distinct from other people. In the same way, people who perhaps go to the same school for years and years will have shared a common social formation, but will have a very rich degree, a diversity of different opinions and views about different things. Those views will be shaped in subtle ways, perhaps by their common experience, but they'll nonetheless be quite quite diverse. So I think you can. This way of understanding culture is consistent with, and in some ways, I think actually helps to explain the patterns that we observe of heterogeneity, of fluidity, of hybridity, and so forth, that are emphasized by essentialists who critique more traditional culture concepts.
Yeah, one of the things I find most interesting about this, you bring up an interesting analog with biological accounts of species, because biologists have turned away from essentialist descriptions of species in terms of particular kinds of traits or characteristics, and instead describe species in terms of their genetic lineage, right? So you're making a similar move, in other words, with culture, that cultures are not described or individuated in terms of particular traits or beliefs or practices, but in terms of their lineage. In this case, it's not genetic, not natural, but a kind of cultural lineage, the uninterrupted process of socialization. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So I think that there's a structural parallel between how we might think about these concepts, so that for biologists, what makes something a distinct species is that it's the product, the precipitate, if you like, of a population lineage that is relatively isolated reproductively from other population lineages, right? So we don't identify distinct species by looking for, specific traits that all members of the species have in common. Instead, there's this more historical or backward-looking way of identifying species as being members of a kind of a lineage, which, in the case of biological species, is understood in terms of reproductive isolation. So I want to say something similar about cultures, that we identify cultures as the precipitates of these lineages, but the lineages are not biological. They're not defined by reproduction, or at least they're not defined by biological reproduction. Instead, they're defined by socialization. They're social lineages in which one generation socializes the next, and then that generation socializes the next, and so on and so forth. So I think there's an interesting parallel there. And in some ways, I think these different ideas come together. We've been talking about culture, but they come together in the concept of ethnicity, where there's both a kind of biological idea there, as well as a cultural idea.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about some of the criticisms of this view. I think William James Booth criticized your view in the APSR, and Phillips in the in the forum and in political theory. I found your responses really persuasive to that. I didn't know if you have encountered other objections to this quite innovative view. One I had in mind was the there's an APSR article by Arash Abizadeh on nationalism, and it's canon.
Yeah,
it's in a little footnote there. So this is kind of geeking out on my part, I guess. But I don't know if you've seen that, but I don't think I'll quite get it right here, what his objection is to your view. But it goes something like this, which is that your view, the social lineage account, actually doesn't escape the problem of essentialism, because what essentialism does is that it picks out essential or core beliefs or values or practices and defines them as a particular culture. Your view abstracts from particular beliefs, values, and practices, but still says that there are essential or core formative institutions that constitute a culture, right? And so in that case, since you're picking out particular essential institutions and saying this one's essential and that one's not essential, would fall prey to the same kind of charges against essentialism. I'm not sure if I got that right, but what do you think about that?
I've had a number of really interesting conversations with Arash about this, and to some extent, I think I kind of gradually worked out the view that's in the book in conversation with Arash. Because a couple of thoughts. One is kind of as you say on a bit on the more geeky side of things. I agree that there's a sense in which the view might be thought of as essentialist. And if you just think of essentialism as the claim that that there's some property that all the members of the kind share in common, then yes, I'm saying that what they share in common is the property of having been formed by this particular social lineage. So the way I try to handle that is by sort of nuancing the conception of essentialism a little bit by saying what essentialists are particularly interested in is what you might think of as non-relational properties. So the claim that there's some trait that all share in common in order for them to be a kind, where that trait isn't a relation to some third thing. And so the view is not essentialist in that sense, since what the members of a culture share in common, on my view, is that they all relate to this common kind of third thing, namely the processes of socialization that they were all subject to. And I think that if we sort of step back from this sort of technical question about how we understand essentialism and think about what's animating the concern about essentialism, I think what's animating it is the thought that contemporary understandings of multiculturalism can't handle heterogeneity, the fact that there are differences within culture, the fact that members of culture typically contest with one another what the meaning of the culture is, or particular meanings within the culture. The fact that cultures are fluid, people are constantly kind of changing their mind and evolving and developing the culture. And so I think those are the sort of real concerns that are kind of animating the concern about essentialism. And I think the social lineage account is able to kind of address those concerns. So even if there's some technical sense in which there's still a kind of residue of essentialism in the view, I don't think it's a residue that we should necessarily be concerned about.
Yeah, I guess just to push a little bit more, which I mean, I guess maybe the the concrete concern would be something like, I think you described it in terms of a social lineage, but I suppose one might say, aren't cultures composed of multiple competing social lineages in the sense that there are, as you described it before, multiple different sources of socialization in any one culture. And so maybe some members will be socialized by particular parts or features of cultures, and others will be socialized by particular features of culture. And they may disagree about what the core socializing institutions are, right? In the way, same way that there may be, you know, disagreements at the level, you know, what are the essential beliefs and values that constitute a culture, right? So, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure at the end of the day what you know, whether this make an actual concrete difference, but I don't know if you understand my meaning. I mean, if there's actually conflicts about what the core socializing institutions are, maybe at that point, you know, it would be hard to individuate the culture at all, I suppose.
Right. So, so on the view that I develop in the book, it's not what people think the influences are, but that's crucial. The crucial question is whether there are in fact, kind of environmental influences that act on kind of everybody in the group at once to some extent, whether they kind of recognize those influences or not. So I mean, going back to, you know, I think one of the first questions you asked, and my answer about always being fascinated between differences between Canada and the United States. I think Canadians always think that they have to sort of struggle to identify the thing that kind of makes them different and try to define the identity. So, and they sort of find it hard to do this. And there's lots of joking about, well, is it really just that we, I don't know, love ice hockey that makes us different, or that we say, you know, sorry more than Americans tend to do. But I actually think that kind of misunderstands the way in which we, you know, cultures differ from one another. I think the fact is, whether they kind of recognize it or not, that Canadians are kind of part of a conversation with other Canadians that is kind of to some extent forced on them by the fact that there's a border, and there are different governments, and there are different media institutions, and Canadians live in closer proximity to one another than they do to Americans. Some Canadians speak French, and more or less nobody in the United States speaks French. It's not an established language in the United States. So there are these differences that are there, kind of whether they're recognized or not. They're kind of part of the environment in which individuals develop their more specific views and allegiances and identities. And so, I mean, I think that for Abizadeh's view objection to really hold, he would have to kind of empirically deny that there are these kind of macro level sort of environmental conditions that simultaneously influence everybody within particular groups and that kind of operate differently for one set of people than they do for another set of people. Maybe he does deny that, but I think that kind of empirically, the world that we live in, we do observe these kinds of influences and patterns that I, you know, try to describe in the book.
Right. Yeah, that's good. I have one other question on this. And sorry to dwell so much on this. Since your APSR article came out on this, it's been quite a particular interest to me. But so I mean, I maybe I'll put the question this way, which is, I think one of the reasons why I and maybe others might be attracted to an essentialist view is that it, in a way, I think captures what people care about when they care about cultures, right? So what people care about when they're members of cultures is that they care about the particular content of them, that they care about the beliefs, values, and practices of the culture. So your account, you sort of step back and see, you know, and focus on or take as core definitive of a culture, the things that shape individuals. So, right, you know, the institutions that have formed them, which seems to be at one level removed from what actually individuals care about. I'm not sure if that's, a worry for you. I mean, I suppose it's one need not, in explaining a normative view of culture, capture what individuals care about. But is that something of concern for you?
Well, I have a story about that, which is that in certain formative contexts, certain social lineages, particular beliefs and values are going to be found with much higher frequency than they are if that social lineage disappears, mm-hmm. right? So it makes sense that people care about their cultures in this social, even on the social lineage account, because they care about particular practices and they have particular beliefs about value, because if the social lineage were to die out because people, you know, were absorbed into, say, a larger cultural structure, the things that they care about, the options that they care about, would be much less likely to be available to them. So I think I can capture that, but I can also capture something else, which I think is important in this, with respect to this topic, which is that although people often care about the particularity of their culture, people also tend to think that there are some particulars that are part of their culture that are regrettable, right? And that they would like to see revised. So, you know, one of the things that I ended up exchanging with Ann Phillips about was gender inequality in culture. And so many people will look at our culture today, particular cultures all over the world, and bemoan the high level of gender inequality that continues to, you know, afflict these cultures. And they'll want the culture to kind of to change over time, right? They want to kind of revise the culture to make it less inegalitarian. And it would be nice if we could have a view of culture that, in a sense, allowed us to do that without thinking that the culture was therefore disappearing as a result of those changes in even, you know, fundamental practices and beliefs. And so I think the social lineage account allows us to say that a culture could still persist even when values that are pretty fundamental to that culture are being kind of overthrown and replaced with more progressive values.
Yeah, that's great. That's quite persuasive. So let's turn to chapter 3, where you move from what is culture to why culture matters, which we've been talking a little bit about here. And you sort of pitch your argument in relation to more or less a standard view in the literature on liberal multiculturalism, which is why culture matters in terms of Kimlicka's argument about autonomy or self-determination, that for Kimlicka, autonomy or self-determination requires a context for one's choices, or to make one's choices meaningful to one, so that self-determination or autonomy is meaningless or empty unless it can be exercised within a particular context of culture. Kimlicka's view has been challenged on this because he says, you can exercise your self-determination within the context of the culture that you're going to be assimilated to. So how do you how does your view sort of relate to that debate, and how does your view sort of avoid the problems of the that are charged against Kimlicka?
So I think that the sort of Kimlicka view can be unpacked in a couple of different ways. So I think the sort of core thought in Kimlicka, it's also I think a core thought in Joseph Raz's writing about multiculturalism, and it's referred to by one or two other of these earlier authors on multiculturalism. But the core thought is that individual freedom or autonomy requires that we have access to an adequate range of options, and then the idea is that the culture that we belong to gives us access and supplies the adequate range of options. And so the kind of conclusion is that we need to protect the cultures, because if they were to disappear, we would lose out on one of these key conditions of individual freedom. As you say, a kind of standard objection to that argument is suggests that, well, we wouldn't necessarily be worse off from the standpoint of the conditions of our freedom if the particular culture in which we were brought up were to disappear, because we could just get our options and from the culture, the more powerful culture into which we are being assimilated. Right? So I think that there's a kind of couple of different responses that are possible for thinkers like Kimlicka and Raz, who are attracted to this mode of argument. One would be to suggest that would be to emphasize the idea of access. So remember that the thought is that you need access to an adequate range of options. And the thought would be that, in fact, the members of a disappearing culture might not be able to access an adequate range of options in the majority, the more powerful majority culture, because they might lack some of the capacities needed to access those options. Most obviously, they might not be able to speak the language in which many of the options of the majority culture are, occur in, or they might lack some other, they might face discrimination, or they might lack the kind of networks and social capital that would allow them to flourish in the majority culture. So I think that's one route that sort of Kimlicka and the others could go in. But the worry I have about that, that argument is, another way of solving the problem, an alternative to multiculturalism, would be a much more vigorous form of what you might think of as liberal nationalism that's designed to ensure that everybody can speak the majority language, that includes a vigorous anti-discrimination policy that tries to promote an inclusive idea of citizenship, that tries to make sure that there aren't terrible differences in terms of networks and social capital and so forth between different subgroups within society. So in a way, one could imagine a solution to if the problem is about access, and one could imagine a non-multicultural solution to the problem. But of course, that's not what Kimlicka and the others want. So that leads me to think that maybe it's not access so much that they should emphasize, but rather the adequacy of the options that members of a minority culture would face if they had to look in the majority culture for their options. And here, I think they might emphasize that those options are not options that that they value, right? They're not either the particular kinds of activities and ends and rituals and pursuits and so forth that were available to them in their minority culture, Or they might emphasize that they value value the speaking of the minority language, and that's not something that they can do in the majority culture. Or they might even have some kind of allegiance to the community itself and say, well, it's true that in some sense I have, you know, a rich range of options in the majority culture, but one of the things that I really cared about was the minority community that I was brought up in, and that's an option that's not available to me in the majority culture. So I think that's in some ways a more promising way to go, and a way of, if you like, rescuing the argument that Kimlicka and others make. But it does lead to a kind of a question, which is, to what degree do the principles of liberal democracy guarantee for people that the options that they happen to care about should be available to those people, right? There might be things that I care about that are harmful to others, and we certainly don't necessarily think that those options ought to be available to me. Or there might be things that I care about that are very expensive, right? Perhaps I care about living a lavish lifestyle, and we don't necessarily think that others owe me the resources so that I can pursue that that way of life. So there's a question on this line of argument about what exactly the claim is that members of a minority culture would have on others, if the animating concern is with having options that correspond to the preferences and values that they in fact have. So that's kind of where so the sort of upshot of the discussion is that I don't think that there's a right to cultural preservation, because that would give people a kind of right to structures in which they can have the things that they happen to care about. But what instead there is something like a right to fair treatment of the things that one cares about. So there's a kind of transition, I think, that going this direction pushes you to think about what fairness requires with respect to people's cultural allegiances, and less about what the kind of conditions of autonomy or freedom are, which is where I think Kimlicka and the others start out from.
Right. Yes. And that gets into your discussion about neutrality of treatment. But before we get there, I wanted to ask briefly about this point, which I think is an interesting one. One point in this section, you say that, you know, under fair conditions of treatment, cultures, one has no moral complaint if one loses one's culture, right? I guess one of the things that occurred to me in thinking about this is, there seem to be quite different, the pull of different cultures. Different cultures have quite different levels of power, right? So American culture, broadly understood, exerts a great deal of power. It has, and it is sort of heavy on spectacle and individuality. I guess one might worry from the perspective of a more traditional culture that's sort of struggling to survive within American culture, say, that even if some kinds of fair conditions were to be applied, that the great difference in power between the two different cultures would sort of swamp the smaller one. Mm-hmm. Think about this in a more conservative way, that, you know, the pull of the materialistic desires of American culture is more powerful than the sort of more traditional wisdom or something like that of another culture. And so one might still have a moral complaint if one loses one's culture, even if, you know, it's under fair terms.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is something that this is a worry that I take up a little bit later in the book. I think it's in the latter sections of chapter 5. I returned to it. Yeah, and I returned to it in chapter 6, which is the chapter about language policy and language rights, because this kind of, you know, you could imagine a version of your concern being raised where kind of English is the sort of dominant and powerful international kind of lingua franca, and then you have other languages that are spoken by you know, much smaller groups of people, and that have kind of less, you know, they don't have big film industries and so forth that are backing them. So there are big differences of power there. So anyways, I try to take up that concern in thinking about language in particular, and then a little bit more generally in chapter 5. And I guess the kind of, you know, the gist of the response is to say that, well, what counts as fair treatment is, to some extent at least, going to be sensitive to some of the factors that that you just described. So I distinguish between, you know, three versions of the worry. One is that there's a kind of economic inequality that corresponds to the cultural difference, and that tends to systematically bolster the majority culture over the minority culture. But I think that is could be described as a kind of unfairness, which ought to be addressed if one was trying to describe what fair treatment of different cultures would look like. Another version of it, I think, would look at historical injustice. So, I mean, if you mentioned the United States, and you know, one obvious example, or some obvious examples in the United States would be kind of contemporary African American culture, cultures of indigenous peoples. So these are cases in which it would be hard to say that there was perfectly fair treatment today, in part because there are a lot of unaddressed historic injustices that are relevant to the sort of current power of these different cultures, right? And then the third kind of goes to the point that you mentioned about individualism, because that's a concern that I too really share. And so there's a worry that I'm, you know, personally quite concerned about, which is that that in a liberal system, people who have more individualistic conceptions of what a good life is, their more individualistic preferences, will systematically find it easier to satisfy their preferences than people who have more collective preferences that involve kind of cooperation with others and doing things with other people, because of the various coordination and collective action problems that people with more collective preferences tend to face. I think that's actually a really big problem when you're thinking about the fate of minority languages, that minority language speakers often systematically face certain incentives to kind of defect from the minority language, even when they care a great deal about the preservation of their language. So I say a little bit in the book about that concern and relate it to my ideas about fairness, but actually that's something I've been working more on. I now have a kind of paper on that topic that, you know, in some ways makes further concessions to, or further develops the worry about this kind of imbalance between individualistic and collectivist preferences that I think is a sort of a general concern that one might have about liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I'd love to see that, because, you know, in part, I mean, I think it was Kim Lacoe originally, or maybe it was Rawls, who used this language of a kind of cultural marketplace. I mean, it strikes me that the procedural model envisions something ultimately like a marketplace, and that itself seems to at least already stack the deck against, you know, collectivist non-marketplace oriented cultures, right?
I think that's right. But what I try to argue, I mean, I kind of assert this more than anything in the book, and then I've tried to work it out subsequently, is that without abandoning a kind of proceduralist framework, one can make room for the idea that there are going to be certain collective action problems and coordination problems that people with more collectivist outlooks face, and that it's appropriate for the state to take measures that try to offset or compensate people for those problems, that offer additional forms of support for cultures that would struggle because of because they're facing these collective action problems. So I think that you can accommodate that sort of non-market idea within a framework that's still, broadly speaking, proceduralist in its character.
Good. Yeah. So let me ask you about neutrality, because this is another one of the core tenets of the book. You revive liberal neutrality, which I think a few theorists have said is dead, but it's clearly not, because this is quite an interesting account you give here. You distinguish you develop a new account of neutrality, which you call neutrality of treatment, which is distinct from the more familiar views of neutrality of intentions, and neutrality of outcomes. Can you say a bit about each of these and why you think your view of neutrality is better than those other ones?
Sure. Yes, I mean, the debate about neutrality has been, I guess, going for, I don't know, 40 or 50 years now. And I think the tendency amongst proponents of neutrality has been to think of neutrality as a matter of the kind of rationale or justification that could be given for the state pursuing a particular policy. So if the state's reason for adopting some policy is that would help a particular conception of the good, or if it's that if the reason rests on the idea that a particular conception of the good, or a particular, say, religion or moral outlook is the correct one, or is a valuable one, then from the point of view of neutrality of justification, that would be a non-neutral policy. Whereas on this approach, there's a set of reasons that might be relied on, having to do with justice, having to do with democracy, and so forth, that if you could just point to those justifications in support of a particular policy, then that policy would count as neutral. But the fundamental thing is that it's a matter of what the nature of the rationale is that could be given for a policy. And then another view of neutrality, which has been called neutrality of outcome or neutrality of effects, tends to be the view that critics of neutrality have. But it emphasizes that to be neutral, the effects of a state's policy would have to be kind of even-handed in their impact on different conceptions of the good. So that it shouldn't be an outcome of a state policy, if that policy is to be neutral, that one conception of the good is ends up doing well, and another conception of the good ends up doing poorly. I think that the second of those views of neutrality seems clearly inadequate for reasons that many political theorists have pointed to, that some of the most basic things that people who are attracted to liberal democracy care about are likely to be deeply unequal in their impact on different conceptions of the good. So basic liberties of freedom of speech and freedom of association, a state that whose constitution protects those liberties is likely to be a state in which it's likely to lead to a situation in which some conceptions of the good, ones that aren't very popular, end up not doing very well, and other conceptions of the good do very well. And that doesn't seem at all an objection, right? There doesn't mean anything wrong with that. It's just people exercising their liberties in the ways that seem best to them. So I think neutrality of effects is kind of an unappealing, unattractive view right from the get-go. Neutrality of justification, I don't necessarily think it should be rejected. I'm kind of agnostic about that. But I think it's insufficient or it's incomplete. In other words, one could think of policies that have the right kind of justification, that have a justification that appeal to the right sorts of neutral considerations. And yet the policy itself would still seem kind of, you know, plainly non-neutral. So the example that I give in the book is imagine a state that is legitimately concerned that it will face instability because of the weak allegiances of citizens to the state itself, and so decides that it will establish the majority religion in order to associate the state with that particular religion, and thereby to strengthen the allegiance of many citizens who belong to the religion and who would be motivated to support the state more if they thought that there was a kind of fusion between the state and that particular religion. So it looks like that policy has the right rationale from the point of view of neutrality of justification. The fundamental rationale is not the truth of the religion, it's just the contingent fact that that religion will strengthen the state, and presumably that's something that a neutralist should care about and accept as a legitimate kind of neutral reason. Nonetheless, if you're establishing a particular religion, it seems like if there's anything that's non-neutral, that ought to count as non-neutral. So it seems like there's a kind of form of neutrality and non-neutrality that isn't really being captured by neutrality of justification.
Good. And so your view, neutrality of treatment, then?
Yeah. So the idea there is that a state is neutral if its laws and policies are equally accommodating of different conceptions of the good, of rival conceptions of the good, where equally accommodating means that the laws and policies impose the same restrictions and burdens on different conceptions of the good, and extend the same benefits to different conceptions of the good. So, you know, a simple example would be it would be a departure from neutrality in that sense if the state were to apply a higher sales tax to some goods that figure in some conceptions of the good than it does to other goods that figure in other conceptions of the good. That would be to sort of non-neutrally treat those different conceptions of the good. Or if you could associate, for the purposes of pursuing conception of the good X, but not for the purposes of pursuing conception of the good Y, then there would be a kind of difference in the rules that apply to each of those conceptions of the good, and you'd say that they're being treated in differently and unequally by the state. But a state that, you know, imposes a uniform rate of tax on different goods and applies the same rules relating to speech and association and so forth to the different goods that and activities that figure in different conceptions of the good, then it would, we could say that it was kind of equally accommodating of those different conceptions, and in that sense, neutral.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the tough cases that is usually used to challenge neutrality. I think this, it's these kinds of cases that make me skeptical of neutrality accounts. So, I mean, I'm thinking in particular about the, you know, typical cases of, you know, religious accounts of the good versus more secular accounts. So on cases about abortion or euthanasia, same-sex marriage, you raise in the book, let's say, you say, given the special significance of sexuality for many people, the denial of marriage rights to same-sex couples is an example of self-determination diminishing non-neutral policy that sends an unjustifiably disparaging and exclusionary message to gays and lesbians. I mean, I suppose one could rewrite that sentence, though, and say the same thing about, you know, Christians, right? That sort of transforming the idea of marriage in the same way has would be disparaging to the other group, or maybe not. I mean, so when you think about these types of tough cases, I know you've had, I think Cecile Laborde pushed you on some of these in the Political Theory Symposium. And my recollection was that you offered something of a kind of libertarian approach. If one way you can be neutral is just not to take a stand, or the state need not take a stand. But in some of these cases, it seems are difficult. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, so one distinction we should make is between kind of what counts as neutral or non-neutral versus why we should care about neutrality, right? So you mentioned facts about disparagement, right? So for me, disparagement, the fact that non-neutral treatment in a particular situation would be reasonably experienced as disparaging by those who are treated in that way is a reason for caring about neutrality, right? Or an additional reason for caring about neutrality. But whether or not a policy is neutral or non-neutral is, you know, it's not based on whether people feel disparaged or not. So that's one, I guess, one thing just to clear up. So I think that on my account, say something like policy of extending the institution of marriage to same-sex couples would certainly count as neutral, and that I think the denial of that benefit would count as non-neutral. It would be a way of, as I said, it'll be a way in which the law would be unequally accommodating of different preferences and conceptions of the good and of forms of sexuality and sexual identity. So, I mean, one might argue that all things considered, this is a case in which we shouldn't be neutral. So one other feature of my view that I didn't mention earlier was that I don't think of neutrality as being a kind of absolute requirement or there being a kind of absolute prohibition on non-neutrality. There are sometimes going to be overriding considerations that lead us to think, no, neutrality, you know, we should depart from neutrality in this or that case. So perhaps that's true with respect to marriage. I don't happen to think it is true, but I mean, my view is consistent with someone arguing that, but I guess I have a hard time imagining how one could square only extending this package of benefits that you know travels under the name of marriage to people with sort of opposite sex preferences and not extending the same benefit of the law to people with same sex preferences. How you could square that with the idea of neutral treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Okay. I guess I just bring up the example to suggest that it's hard to have neutral treatment at all, right? So that either way you go, it's not neutral, right? I mean, I think that, again, the abortion example, I think, is the one that theorists have used, say, from Michael Sandel onwards, that either way you go, with either allowing abortion or not allowing abortion, is non-neutral, right? Because it either admits the truth of the view of the good of one side or the other. Or, you know, Sandel also uses the euthanasia example, right? If you go in the direction of a euthanasia on the grounds of individual autonomy and sort of in an attempt to say that this is neutral with respect to the good, it still is incorporates implicitly some account of the good, in the sense that you view life as something that's, you know, under your control or your choice, which is in contrast to a religious view of the good that envisions life as a gift that's not to be. You understand? I mean, that's the only worry I hear. And, you know, not to defend one side or the other as neutral or not. It's just, it strikes me that some of these tough cases make it difficult to defend neutrality.
I certainly agree that the two cases you just mentioned, abortion and euthanasia, are, I mean, they're just tough cases to think about in general. And I don't know whether, and I don't claim that my theory of neutrality really kind of helps, I think, wrestle with the key ideas there, which have to do with, you know, what do we mean by sanctity of life, and what does it imply for these kinds of beginning of life and end of life choices that we face. I don't know whether neutrality is an especially helpful concept, I guess, in thinking about that particular question. I do think it's maybe more helpful in the marriage case, that I think it's true that the opponent of same-sex marriage is going to say, well, you're just siding with that neutrality just seems to be siding with those who want to extend marriage to same-sex couples. But I think that they're then working with a kind of effects-based conception of neutrality at that point, rather than the treatment-based view of neutrality that I'm resting my argument on. I think that it's true that neutrality of treatment can have unequal consequences for different conceptions of the good, but that's not how we're thinking about neutrality. We're thinking about neutrality as kind of applying the same rules, extending the same benefits, imposing the same burdens on different conceptions of the good. And I think that it would be harder for a proponent of traditional marriage to point to some benefit of the state that is being withheld unequally to their conception, but extended to other conceptions, or to some burden that's being imposed on them that's not also being imposed on other conceptions.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, so let me turn to the notion of recognition. We're about an hour and 20 minutes into the conversation. I haven't asked you about the title of the book. Okay, right. Well, so you apply this notion of neutrality of treatment to culture when you in discussing the notion of equality of recognition, which is the sort of account that you gave when we were talking earlier about fair treatment. So equal recognition is the form of fair treatment that the state should accord to different cultures. So when you talk about recognition, what do you mean? I particularly contrast your view with Charles Taylor and with Axel Honneth, who have I think some more familiar views about recognition. How's your view different?
They tend to think of recognition as a very kind of foundational concept, I guess, in political philosophy. That in Honneth's case, in some of his earlier writings on this, he suggested, for instance, that a leading reason to care about justice is that unjust treatment of someone amounts to a kind of failure of recognition. So there's a sense, I think, on his view, and I think there's something of this as well in Taylor's famous essay, The Politics of Recognition, in which, you know, there's a sense in which recognition is kind of a master concept. It's a sort of fundamental thing that, you know, we owe one another, certainly when we're thinking about what we owe one another politically. For me, recognition is a much more downstream idea. So I think of recognition as something that the state does through public policy, through the rights that it the legal rights that it creates, for instance. And it's a form of recognition would be a kind of accommodation of a particular conception of the good or religion or culture that is kind of customized to the beliefs and practices associated with that conception of the good or religion or culture, where that conception of the good is important to the identity of the people who pursue it. So, you know, an example that I give, I think, of recognition in this sense would be, in Canada at least, Good Friday is always a public holiday. It isn't here, but in Canada it is. And so that's an accommodation, right? That, so it's a kind of a benefit that makes it easier for people who religiously observe Good Friday to take the day off work, to go to services, etc. And it's not just an accommodation, but it's an accommodation that's customized to fit their beliefs. You know, why that particular day? Well, that particular day figures in their religious outlooks. And of course, the thought is that this is something important to do because of the importance of religion in people's lives. So there's an idea of identity there that I think is doing some work. So that would be, I would call that a form of recognition. It's a customized form of accommodation of an identity related aspect of a person's conception of the good, right? So, the thought is that the state, the more general thought is the state is often called upon to make what I call formatting decisions about public institutions. So they'll have to make decisions about what languages public institutions will operate in, what languages public services and education and so forth will be provided in. They have to make decisions about, I mentioned holidays already, but they have to make decisions about the symbols and kind of self-presentation of the state to its citizens. And they also, importantly, I think for this topic, have to make decisions about what the jurisdictional boundaries of the state will be. So should we think about all of the United States as being a single unified political jurisdiction, or should we think that, at least with respect to some questions, it's better for decisions to be made at a more regional level through federalism and state? So that those are sort of formatting decisions. And I think that, you know, that they those decisions end up very frequently being forms of accommodation of different conceptions of the good. So to conduct business in English rather than Spanish, for instance, or to conduct business in English and in Spanish, is to respond in different ways to people's kind of linguistic preferences and identities and capacities, right? So it's a form of recognition that the state is taking or not taking when it makes these formatting decisions, in the sense that it's a kind of customized form of accommodation of an identity related aspect of someone's conception of the good. So the sort of general claim is that where the state is forced to make these formatting choices and therefore is kind of inescapably involved in recognition, then rather than just recognizing the majority's outlook, it ought to engage in equal recognition. And that's sort of ends up being the sort of headline normative idea that then undergirds the discussion in the latter parts of the book of particular topics like language and federalism.
Yeah, that's good. Let me ask you about a particular topic that you don't take up that much, which is about education. So what would it mean to extend recognition to different cultures in education? I can imagine a couple different possibilities, right? I mean, assuming that the state is going to offer public education, which most non-libertarians think it should do. So is the idea that public education curriculum is going to incorporate, you know, many different representatives or many different voices from the different cultures? So in that sense, be a multiculturalism education? Or is the idea that, you know, we want to design educational curricula, many different educational curricula for the many different cultures, and so push decisions down to the local, more local level, maybe develop charter schools that allow different cultures to foster their own particular cultures within schools? Or maybe is it some mixture of the two?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be pretty careful in this area. As I said, you know, a few minutes ago, I don't think of neutrality as being a kind of absolute principle, and this idea of equal recognition is based on an idea of neutral treatment. So I also don't think of equal recognition as being an absolute principle. One can imagine situations in which, say, in the educational context that you mentioned, equal recognition would compete with important other values such as social mobility and economic equality. So, you know, in the context of the United States, where cultural differences tend to coincide to a pretty high degree with economic differences, I think one ought to have real concerns about forms of equal recognition that create separate institutions, right? That create a kind of segregation, even voluntary segregation, along cultural lines in the name of multiculturalism, I think would probably have sort of disastrous consequences for social mobility and economic inequality in this country. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And insofar as equal recognition is an idea that we'd want to see instantiated in the public education system, I think we're better off looking for ways which don't create separate institutions, but kind of create kind of equality that's internal to common public institutions. So, you know, in the area of language, I think an example of this would be two-way bilingualism, which has become quite common in many parts of the country. Even here in Princeton, New Jersey, one of the four elementary schools, most of its classes are taught both in Spanish and in English. That's partly, of course, to expand the linguistic repertoires of the Anglophone kids, but it's also because they're, you know, in the neighborhood that school serves, there's a significant Latino population, and so they're able to go to, you can think of that as a kind of recognition of that culture and that, you know, that group's situation. So that would be a sort of example of equal recognition that I think is kind of internal to public institutions and doesn't sort of create the, you know, the sort of separatist outcome that I think in the context of the United States with its particular socioeconomic character would be, really concerning. Choices about, I gave the example of language there, but I mean, I think there are other choices about the curriculum that would be you know, in which questions of equal recognition are relevant. So you're thinking about what books should students be exposed to, what histories should they learn. Obviously, there are a lot of different considerations that are relevant to making those choices. I mean, I think we all want our kids to learn, you know, to read good books and not bad books. And we probably think that no matter what their background is, they have some interest in being exposed to diversity. But even beyond those considerations, I think there are considerations of equal recognition that are kind of relevant to curricular choices that our schools are making, or that we make when we're educating the public at the university level.
Yes, we're out of time, but I really can't end the discussion without asking you about, you know, the broader context of multiculturalism. I mean, you wrote the book was published in 2014. This is well before Donald Trump's election. I mean, since the book has been published, there's been a marked move towards nationalism in many Western countries, much more skepticism of multiculturalism. Some people say, you know, multiculturalism is dead. Others say, no, it's just more entrenched in the system. Do you think, have your thoughts changed at all in the past several years about multiculturalism and in this broad way in which the multiculturalism and nationalism debate has moved?
They haven't changed dramatically. No, my views, that is. I do think that, you know, in the United States in particular, the prospects for multiculturalism seem bleak, and at least in the current political situation. Of course, you know, an optimist might think that there will be, and are already, forms of counter mobilization that hopefully will come to fruition in years to come. And having some theoretical guides to what that might eventually look like, I think, is still something of great value. I've been interested in some of the debates going on in Europe as well. One of the chapters of the book, which we didn't really get a chance to talk about. Talks about issues of regional autonomy and federalism for national minorities, as opposed to secession, which of course is an alternative way of in which a national minority might seek to have greater self-government over its affairs. And you know, as you know, there have been a kind of marked increase in the number of secessionist movements that we find, especially these days in Europe. So you think about Catalonia is perhaps the best example, but Scotland is another recent example. And I guess there's a sense in which even Brexit is a kind of example of this trend, a secessionist trend as well. So that's a place in which I've continued to, you know, think that, you know, some of the ideas discussed in the book are relevant, and I've continued to kind of work more on those ideas and think about how they kind of might be applied to some of these contemporary disagreements and crises in our current world.
Alan Patton, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Jeffrey, thanks very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.